सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है.
वेलकम टू सोच विचार. वी आर बैक विथ प्रोफेसर पॉल केर्नी टू ट्राई एंड डिस्कस पॉलिसी एंड हाउ पॉलिसी इज मेड फर्दर. हियर आई वुड लाइक टू टेक अप प्रोफेसर पॉल, आई'd लाइक टू टेक अप द इशू ऑफ एविडेंस बेस्ड पॉलिसी व्हिच हैज नाउ बिकम वेरी वेरी सेक्सी एंड इन वोग. हाउ डू यू डिफाइन एविडेंस बेस्ड पॉलिसी?
Well, I mean, that's a bit like the what is policy question. So I tend to only use the phrase evidence-based policymaking to say that it doesn't exist. So
good point. I like
that. Yeah. So, but I think the definition people have in mind is that scientific evidence should be privileged in policy decisions. You know, that there are many knowledge claims out there, but only scientific knowledge should, you know, be put on a pedestal. And I think that tends to be, depending on how narrow thinking people are, but some people would also have a narrow definition of what counts as scientific evidence. And it would be to do with, you know, a hierarchy of evidence in which experimental evidence is at the top, and there's nothing quite as good as the systematic review of randomized controlled trials. Mm-hmm. I think people often use the phrase evidence-informed policymaking when they get into, you know, more nuanced discussions. But as soon as you do that, you know, the benefit of the phrase evidence-based policymaking is that you really state what you want, which is, a privileged place for science. When you talk about evidence-informed, you're really talking about, well, we would like to recognize many forms of evidence, but we're not quite sure what its role might be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But tell me, is this something new? I mean, it's a phrase that's now become very, very common and very desirable. Everybody who's discussing policy questions speaks on evidence-based policy with much authority. Have we recently discovered it, or has policy always been evidence-based?
It's certainly, I think if you did one of those Google searches, I think the phrase, there would be a spike in attention to the specific wording. I think in the past, we would have just used different phrases to talk about the same thing. So I think, you know, maybe 50 years ago, we would have talked about, for example, rational policy making or technocratic policy making. And then, you know, later on, we might have talked about, evaluation informed policy making. You know, so I think there have just been a sort of succession of different ways to describe this. And I think it's now different people trace the rise in the brand of evidence-based policymaking to different sources. But certainly, for example, in the UK, it was the sort of New Labour government used the phrase very explicitly to tell a story about how it was going to do key parts of its business. You know, it started to focus on phrases like what works. And it would be linked to the sense that you could somehow take the politics of policy making by focusing on evidence and what works and getting rid of, you know, such a focus on ideology.
But if I go back in history and I look at even what happened during the medieval times or the Renaissance or whatever, I find sort of, for example, the many governments hiring major, I mean, like Francis Bacon was employed by Queen Elizabeth as a Lord Chancellor. And I'm sure he did not negate evidence wherever he could find it. He may not have had econometrics or he may not have had surveys, but he did look at evidence. At the same time, when I go back and look at, for example, the reform movement in England in the 19th century, or UK, I should say, I mean, the factory reform or the various reforms that took place, anti-slavery, all these things were also based on a wide discussion, based on whatever evidence that was available. Then we come down to the the welfare movement or the progressive movement in the US. Again, there was a widespread discussion. And as you recall, people even went into factories and worked there to collect real-time evidence and reported it in newspapers, etc. So I would say evidence has been part of policymaking forever. And it was not just econometrics or randomized controlled trials. It was observation. It was direct experience. It was, for example, the sanitation movement in England came out of the research conducted by for cholera by that famous doctor, and the movement began. So yes, people have policymakers have responded to demands which came out of evidence of people's experience. So what is new in this evidence-based policy, or is it just an economist's way of developing their own market?
Well, I mean, one decent explanation, I think, is that the language is used increasingly by people who want to privilege their own kind of evidence in the policy process. So I think often when people talk about or they complain about, you know, policy-based evidence instead of evidence-based policy, they're frustrated by their relative exclusion from a political process. I think there is something to be said for, you know, people talking about evidence-based policymaking when they really mean that they want to privilege their own evidence or their own way of thinking about it. So there's nothing new there. Mm-hmm. Maybe the novelty comes from advances in the way that we gather evidence. So, you know, as you know, information technology and computer technology has advanced, we have more large scale ways to gather evidence in a scale that we couldn't have envisaged in the past. And maybe some people think that that scale of evidence gathering should be matched in mm-hmm. evidence use within government. Mm-hmm. You know, so maybe there's a link there. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But another thing that I observe, at least, is that there seems to be no objective evidence. You mentioned smoking recently. Now, smoking lobby has, as you know, I mean, widely known now, that they've been investing in concocting evidence in their favor. Mm. And it delayed legislation for a long time. And even now, there's, as Donald Trump says, lots of fake evidence being produced on every side. But we also see that the same evidence is interpreted differently by Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah.
And we don't get anywhere, even with evidence available, because ultimately evidence has to be interpreted by human beings. And we do have some kind of tinted lenses to look at evidence. So is there something such as objective evidence?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that in some areas we get as close as practically possible to that idea. I think that's what we could say. So, I mean, for example, the evidence for the link between smoking and ill health, I think if you don't accept that causal connection, then you don't quite believe in cause and effect or reality at all, you know. So there is a kind of there's a low bar to accept certain forms of evidence, mm-hmm. But I think in most cases, what we're really talking about, I mean, you do have these maybe slightly extreme examples where some people don't accept that there is evidence for climate change or something like that. So you can't really get to solutions. But there are lots of areas in which
Donald Trump doesn't accept it.
Well, indeed. So there are these issues where people just don't accept the same version of the world, and it's difficult to then discuss the details of evidence. But I would say in most cases you have a certain baseline that people can agree on that help us identify the size of a policy problem to some extent. And then there might be more debate on the evidence of the solutions to those problems. You know, so if you go back to the tobacco example, you know, eventually in many countries and at the WHO level, you know, the scientific evidence on the relationship between smoking and ill health was set in stone. Mm. And the question really was, what's the evidence for these interventions to reduce smoking? Okay. Mm-hmm. And you could see much more debate there because you were not only trying to work out how to evaluate, you know, things like social change, which are incredibly complex, but you're also trying to combine that with a sense of what the state should do and how much you should interfere in people's lives, you know, even if that intervention is effective. So I think that's when you really get into those debates about, the line between evidence of effectiveness and your sort of normative questions about how effective you want to be.
Okay, but I also see that probably the better way, or correct me if I'm wrong, probably the better way to look at it is that evidence becomes overwhelming when it is properly debated and understood, which is, I go back to my example of Hayek versus Keynes or Friedman versus Samuelson, and when it is, or even the progressive movement, when evidence became overwhelming in terms of people who accepted the evidence, then we had a policy change. So is evidence without a debate within the country a good way to go, or should we first understand the evidence and debate it and develop an ownership of the solution?
Well, certainly ownership matters. So, I mean, there's a couple of things there. I mean, one, I think the examples you give are debates between people who have come to a level of agreement about the terms of the debate. You know, if you have debates between economists, they might not agree on key points, but they have a kind of fundamental language and understanding of the world that's the same that they can build on. And I don't think that's true when you have a much wider discussion between people with many different backgrounds. And so then if you're thinking about, you know, deliberative exercises, a lot of them are trying to, you know, they're geared towards seeing if people understand the world in the same way at all, you know, to build a discussion on. And sometimes that's possible and sometimes it's not.
I mean, two key problems that I see just now. One is globalization. The other is climate change. And despite, I think, 50 years of discussion and 50 years of research, we really don't seem to be arriving at any clear understanding. I won't say evidence, but any clear understanding of what the problem is. For example, climate change. Yes, you and I would agree there's overwhelming evidence, and I am sitting in Washington, D.C., approaching with a storm approaching, and we're all sort of trying to figure out how to deal with it. But yet, at the policy level, at the larger level, there is no clear evidence, as can be seen by the Paris Accord and other places, that climate change is a real problem and we are not acting for it. Same thing on globalization. Despite all kinds of debates, we are totally confused, and we are seeing, in fact, a very big retreat on trade policy around the world. How do you explain that?
Well, I mean, the thing I would say about globalization is we would start by working out if we could agree on what it means. So I think for some people, it means a positive story about widening trade and sharing information and becoming closer together despite being, you know, geographically further away. I think for other people, globalization is a relatively, you know, it's a source of great anxiety because it's a sort of a push towards convergence with other countries. It's a loss of identity, and it causes, you know, major populations to wonder what their future is in the world. You know, so I think with that kind of issue, there's just a kind of fundamental disagreement about if globalization is a good or a bad thing, and we don't quite always recognize that it will benefit some people or countries more than others. You know, so that's globalization, I think, is largely about power as much as evidence. In terms of climate change, I mean, I think even if, so let's say everyone, you know, had the same basic agreement on the level of threat and the size of the problem, they wouldn't agree on whose fault it was. You know, so often these international agreements are about some countries trying to put pressure on other countries to change how they do things and to, you know, to reduce their economic growth, for example. And these are negotiations about who should do most or shoulder most of the burden for changes to respond to climate change. And I don't think, you know, evidence and the size of the problem doesn't really help us make those kind of choices.
So you've written a book on the politics of evidence. Can you tell us what, very briefly, I mean, a book is a big thing to summarize, so I hate to put you in a position, but can you just briefly tell us what are the key points in the politics of evidence?
Well, I mean, I can do it simply if I focus on the more provocative part of it, which is essentially a story of, part of the reason I wrote it was because I read an article by Catherine Oliver and colleagues, and they said that there are over, there are 150 articles written by people in, you know, health sciences about the lack of evidence-based policymaking. Mm-hmm. And they say very few of them draw on any policy theory at all. So I thought, well, what would the injection of insights from policy theories tell us? And I think they would give us a sense that without those insights, people talk about the barriers between evidence and policy in relation to simple things like better communication, timeliness, and more science literacy within government. Now, I think what I was trying to do with the book was say that, you know, these wouldn't actually solve more fundamental issues, which such as, you know, that policymakers are really looking to find shortcuts to ignore almost all evidence. And I think that shift, in a way, I think is important, because lots of scientists, I think, try and respond to a lack of attention to evidence by producing more of it. To think that, you know, if a 500-page report won't work, let's go for 1,000. You know, when they actually should be thinking about how can we deal with our audience? How can we understand what they want to try to do? And how can we fit our evidence around that agenda? And it's easier said than done, but I think there's a kind of mindset issue there about how you think of evidence, and to stop about thinking about producing it and then try and working out what to do with it, and instead thinking at the start of what evidence people demand and what they use it for. And then the second side of the book is really about describing the policy process that we talked about and thinking about the implications. And I suppose the biggest implication is that there's no, you'd have to be really lucky to have a direct and quick impact with evidence you produce. Instead, you're much better off, I think, developing relationships within government for the long term, so that you can build up trust in yourself and you can work out what people demand in terms of evidence and what the right time is to try and sell it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just tell me, finally, a couple of questions. What would you suggest to a developing country like India or Pakistan to develop better evidence for policy, to use that evidence to inform policy, and to make better policies? Because really, part of the problem that we have is we just can't seem to get a handle on policy. And we are bumbling around and trying to create all kinds of good things, but end up shooting ourselves in the foot.
Well, I mean, I know that. Let me tell you what I wouldn't advise first. So I think most people ask that question from a science background and would say, develop better ways to gather evidence. I think that's often the agenda from international efforts. I mean, so it is important to gather better evidence. But for me, the thing that makes the difference is clarity on defining what the problem is you're trying to solve. So I think often the problem with evidence and policy is it's hard to work out what people are trying to do and therefore the evidence that would help them do it. So for example, the things that I would focus on are things like we do a lot of work on trying to reduce inequalities within populations, and a lot of it is through so-called prevention or early intervention work. You know, so you intervene earlier in people's lives to reduce inequalities before they get too wide. And that sounds so simple, but when you get into that, you find that policymakers, they really don't quite make enough sense of it to know how the evidence would help them. So for me, it's all about clarity of intent before you, so that you can determine the demand for the evidence.
So basically, what you're saying is that we must try and understand our problems better. Quite frankly, you're absolutely right. We don't invest enough time in developing better questions. We seem to rush along because we feel that there's poverty. We must solve the poverty problems. We charge in this direction or that direction. Sometimes we build microcredit, sometimes we build welfare systems, sometimes we build insurance systems. We are kind of contradicting ourselves all the time first. But then there's a wider problem that our academic industry is trying to engage in developing serious evidence. So lots of econometrics, lots of RCTs, but very little ability to understand what they mean. And when it comes to the policymaker, they don't understand these things at all. So they end up being very confused. in the end, we get something that is really a hodgepodge and never seems to hit the objective. The instruments and objectives are totally out of control. Any thoughts on that? Should, for example, we get the academics more involved? Should the policymakers themselves be debating more? Should Parliament be debating more? How can we affect the system?
Well, it certainly wouldn't hurt for policymakers and academics to speak more often, because I think then, at the very least, academics can understand to a greater extent what policymakers are trying to do. So I think the issue with an RCT is you really have to have a clear idea about what you're trying to do before you try and measure the effect of an intervention. This is part of the reason why a lot of evidence from RCTs don't travel well, because their effectiveness is closely linked to the original intent of the intervention. And as soon as you change the context or change the policymakers, then it becomes less relevant. So I think a sort of good research design and which you're trying to design evidence for policy is to work with policymakers long enough to work out what what they think the problem is and how the evidence would help them.
Well, finally, Professor Paul, policymakers really are not looking at the domestic thought industry. They are totally taken up with the international agencies and with the international aid efforts to improve them, because the aid efforts come with money and they have bells and whistles. And they bring along McKinsey's and high-powered names. Does that affect the policy process at all? Or is it okay to have the external agencies and just the policymakers engage? Domestic thought and participation is ruled out.
Well, I think we're talking there about sources of ideas. I think you can see the same kind of global diffusion of ideas in a lot of countries. But then we think about how people in each country make sense of those ideas. So the same basic proposition can have a very different meaning and implication in each country. And I think as long as each country's government has a clear sense of what it's trying to get from these ideas, how to make sense of them in a local context, it's not too worrying. I think the bigger worrying factor would be if they took an idea about policy success in one country and simply emulated it without thinking about the differences between the exporting and the importing countries. You would have to do it thoughtfully, I think, rather than just expect to transfer no problems.
Thank you very much, Professor Paul. My last question to you, which I ask most of my guests, is what would you recommend? Let me put it this way. What is it, a book, movie, whatever you like, that inspired you in your life? And what would you recommend this to people who are listening to this podcast? What do you think that they should read, or website or movie, whatever you think is worth looking at and transformative?
Oh, right. Well, the line's almost a blank. Well, let me give you, I suppose, I quite like the story of the Emperor's New Clothes. I start that with students, where I think the moral is supposed to be that, you shouldn't surround yourself by people who only agree with you, and you shouldn't be afraid to speak up if you think that that people are agreeing to something that's not quite right. Now, the thing that I find amusing over time is that each year, fewer and fewer students know that story. So I find that any cultural reference I have these days, I have to explain them in some depth, and they kind of lose their impact because of that.
Fascinating. That's great. I think I'll use it in my class. Great. Wonderful. Thank you, Professor Paul. Thank you very much. Very kind of you. And I look forward to hearing from you again, and hopefully take you on again to learn more public policy issues from you.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.